All right, James, it is our pleasure to welcome our co-favorite guest. I don't want to insult Mark Masters. Do you think he'll be insulted if we say favorite?
No, they're definitely the tag team, though. If one of you or I ever croaks, then they're going to be the top candidates to replace us to keep the Leaf Report going into its second decade.
Well, this person already has his own wildly successful podcast. He doesn't really need this one.
No, would you like to introduce him? It's not a choice. You have to do it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's our buddy, Chris Johnson. Hi, Chris.
Good to hear from you guys. I guess we can't travel on the same planes or anything, just in case. Otherwise, there's concerns about the lineage of this podcast living on.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's the biggest reason that I'm not on the road as much anymore, is they want to protect the podcast. So,
do you think that would be the headline? Athletic podcast hosts doomed.
You know, I heard something random that I've never heard recently, that NFL teams actually put a player from each position on each bus because they travel on so many buses just in case there's an accident. So
seriously,
it is something people have to think about.
All right. Well, we are here to talk.
You don't even know what to do with that info.
It kind of blows my mind a little bit that the two quarterbacks or two of the three might be on a different bus from the other one. We'll stay away from your Dallas Cowboys. Let's talk trade deadline, and obviously we'll talk Leafs. I think one of the more interesting components to this is the competition around them, CJ, like Boston, Florida, Tampa. How much do you think of an influence that will be on Brad Tree Living in the Leaf front office? Just knowing that, I mean, for example, like if I don't get Noah Hanifin, one of those teams is going to get Noah Hanifin. If I don't get an upgrade on defense, those teams are going to get better and we're going to be standing still.
I think it's a factor, you know, but the one thing the Leafs have in common with the other teams around them in the standings is they just don't have a lot of assets to trade. I think we've had kind of the same teams in a position of adding at multiple deadlines. And obviously the Leafs have been there going back many years and have obviously expended to a lot of draft capital and doing it. And, you know, so is Boston. So is Florida. So is Tampa. All these teams have traded multiple first round picks in the last number of deadlines. And so I think that we're at this strange time where the buyers just don't seem to have as much ammo as they normally have, not to mention the cap considerations that comes with those moves. So, you know, we're recording this on Tuesday morning, you know, really not that far out from the Friday deadline. And I still get a sense in the calls and texts I've had this morning, like there's a lot of gauging of the market. There's a lot of uncertainty out there about what the prices will end up being. So it doesn't feel as much like we use these war terms, but like an arms race or something, as much as it's a little bit more of a patient kind of deadline, at least at this point. Now, of course, one or two moves could set off a chain of events that, you know, have everyone lose their minds. But, you know, at this stage, I think the Leafs and a number of the other contending teams are just not sure how much they want to trade away for some of these players, because with respect to the players that are in play, it's just not as strong of a trade deadline in terms of quality that we've seen in some previous years.
What's your, you know, we're like a little more than 72 hours out, CJ. What's your, if you had to handicap it, what are the chances that the Leafs don't do much of anything at the deadline? And then on the flip side, what do you think the chances are they do something really significant?
I think it's very, very unlikely they do nothing. But by doing something might be adding almost like a seventh, you know, defenseman or something, which, you know, yeah. I don't know how excited that will get people. But I would be surprised if they've made their last trade for this season at this point. The odds of something significant seem a little... It's just hard to pull that together, right? I mean, there's only a couple players that are probably in the mix that if you're removing to add, and some of those players have no movement clauses and the like. And so, and let's face it, the fact that Toronto's gone on a pretty good last month here, I think, you know, remove some of the urgency that, or some of those thoughts that might've been there a month ago. And so, you know, the only way I see something significant happening, if you're trading someone like TJ Brody off the roster, or, you know, maybe at one point you might have looked at Bertuzzi, although he's one of the guys with a no movement clause. You know, someone who's on an expiring deal to create the necessary room to really shake something up. You know, I just, that doesn't seem like that's in the air quite as much. I think really what the Leafs are weighing is, whether to trade their first round pick or not. It's really the primary kind of asset they have to offer. I mean, I suppose, you know, one of their top prospects, like an Easton Cowan, could be at least thought about. But I don't really get the impression that's something that they're all too eager to do. And so, you know, I think really the consideration now, unless something comes out of nowhere, maybe a player that none of us are anticipating becomes available, if, you know, if Seattle's willing to move someone like Adam Larson, which at this point in time, I don't believe they are. I mean, something could come up, I suppose, in the 72 hours that changes, you know, where the Leafs' mindset's at. But, you know, otherwise, I really think the big decision is moving the first or not, you know, where you're going to get more, you know, of a potentially substantial player, or are you just, you know, nibbling around the fringes and making another Lyubushkin-esque deal or two?
Well, I think what's interesting when you mention the first, and like you mentioned those other teams, I don't believe Boston, Florida, or Tampa have their first round pick in 2024, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know that offhand? I think that's true. Let's assume it's true. And if it's not, whatever.
It is. It's sort of true. I think the Florida pick is all tied up in the Tkachuk, Calgary. I think that there's conditions on the pick, but like generally speaking, that those teams don't have their first rounders. And Tampa, I mean, look, Tampa has been trading more picks than anyone the last number of years.
Well, so what I'm getting at is in theory, like the Leafs could win a competition for, if those teams are all competing, they could in theory win the competition with their first round pick. But I guess like you pointed out, like, and like your trade board indicates, there's not a lot of players that you'd be like, yeah, really want to trade my first round pick. But the problem is like, they don't have a second. So like, how do you think they weigh all that stuff where it's like, okay, well, if we don't want to spend our first, but we want to get someone who's like pretty good, we don't have a second. So we like, what do we do? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's why you got to be smart. And I think if you look out there, I mean, Vegas has a first round pick, Edmonton has a first round pick. I mean, the teams you mentioned could always trade a 2026 first rounder or something as well. So it's not as though these other teams don't have any first round picks, but you know, I think that you have to kind of decide, okay, there's not really that many highly motivated buyers, I'll call them, with 2024 first rounders that are likely to move here. I mean, can we wait a little longer and squeeze two players out in one trade, or you know, what is the best use of that asset? I think that that's kind of a little bit what's going on. You know, and this, the lack of a second rounder is a problem because we've already seen Chris Tanev move for a second rounder, and the fact the Leafs don't have one this year, next year, or the year after has been a complicating factor because they obviously don't have a lot of prospects that teams covet, mostly because they've been trading their picks. It's not because they just haven't drafted a whole lot. And so the Leafs cupboard is truly getting bare. And I think that they really want to be mindful and careful of what they do with their most attractive, you know, tradable assets. And, you know, it's a little too soon to say exactly how that's going to break. But, you know, Brad Treliving is certainly a GM that's very active on the phones. You know, it sounds like he's been having pretty ongoing conversations on a number of different players. And, you know, what that tells me is they'll just be in a position to make what they deem to be the best decision when it gets a little bit more urgent, because, you know, this has just been a really, really quiet trade market compared to especially last season, which maybe was abnormally busy in the couple of weeks leading up to and on deadline day. But this is going to be a late breaking market. At least that's how it feels to me now.
A lot of the talk around the Leafs' first round pick and should they use it or shouldn't they use it was around Chris Tanev and maybe to a lesser extent, Noah Hanifin. Obviously they're not getting Tanev. It doesn't feel like they're going to get Hanifin. One thing I struggle with is even if they decide that they're okay moving the first round pick, who would they even trade that for? Like, is there someone on the market that
James, do you want an answer?
Is there someone on the market that would make sense? I want an answer from CJ. I don't know what you're going to say. Well, I think there's someone that makes sense, like for them to even move the pick for.
I think that there's at least consideration for David Savard, you know, who signed beyond the season, who doesn't have a two owners of a cap hit to begin with. And I think, well, I know Montreal's indicated a willingness to retain salary if they move Savard and they're getting the right assets back. You know, Montreal doesn't, for the same reasons, because he is signed, they don't have to trade him now. He could be I think they hope to be competitive next season, but if they're not, he could be a deadline, you know, defenseman in play next year if they don't do it now. But I think that's an example of one that could make sense. You know, I mentioned Adam Larson earlier. Doesn't seem like the Kraken want to move him, but, you know, the Kraken are only just now, you know, Monday, they took Alex Wenberg out of their lineup in Calgary. you know, which is the first in, you know, willingness where they're going to be a seller. You know, Wennberg is a pending UFA. They tried to sign him to an extension and are now going to trade him. You know, maybe once they get in a selling mode, something could make sense. I mean, those are two names that jump out to me. Savard is certainly more available at this point in time than I would say Larson is. But yeah, there's not a lot of players. I think if you're giving up the first, you probably aren't doing it for a rental in this circumstance. If you're the Leafs, I'm just not sure that makes sense with the current market, the current players, and just, you know, where everything's kind of trending right now.
Well, James,
there's one more year left on his deal at 3.5, just for people that don't know. And then Jonas, let's hear whatever wacky idea you have for the first round pick.
No, that was my wacky idea. And I have a wacky story coming up on The Athletic. So this is the question I wanted to ask you, and CJ can kind of give his thoughts as well. You mentioned like maybe they shouldn't trade the first round pick for a rental. So I would ask you guys, if the choice is between Savard at 1.75 for this year and next, or Hanifin just as an expiring, like you can just get him and he's just like you traded for Ryan O'Reilly last year, expiring contract. James, like of those two, do you just prefer Savard because he signed, because he more easily maybe fits in? Like which of those two, if those options were on the table, would you pick?
I don't love the idea of giving up the first round pick for a guy who's going to play 25 games for a year or whatever. Like I think we've seen that movie and I understand why the Leafs don't want to do it. So, I mean, is that the only thing you have to give up to get Hanifin? Cause it feels like he's going to go for more than that.
Yeah. So. It's more than that. And you would be making the deal knowing he's not signing, like that. It's been pretty clearly conveyed that he wants to play in the US beyond the season. And, you know, he does have a limited no trade clause. The Leafs are not on that list. So they could be, he is eligible to be traded to Toronto and play out the remainder of the season, but you'd be making the move knowing that, it's not in his mind to stay.
This has sure become a real thing where players don't want to play in Canada. Eh? Like it feels like before it was always kind of like the no trade clauses would have like Winnipeg on it and some of the colder places. Now it feels like, I don't know. Is it because there's more American players in the league? Is it because of what they went through during COVID? Like, why do you think that there's more reticence to play for a Canadian team, Chris?
I don't know. I mean, in this case, at least Hanifin is willing to play for the Leafs now. Like, they're not included. I think he has a 7 or 8 team no trade, and they're not one of the teams on there. You know, but zooming out, you're right. There's maybe a trend there. I mean, look, Noah Hanifin's at a point where he's going to be an unrestricted free agent, and that's, not a lot of players get there with leverage, you know, relatively speaking. And, you know, he's a Boston guy. He's spent the last number of years in Calgary. And I think, you know, he's got 24 teams to choose from in the US. I mean, I'm not saying they all want him as a free agent, but, you know, there's lifestyle considerations. There's probably tax considerations, you know, being closer to friends and family. I mean, it's not all that much different than all the guys that have come home and played in Toronto in reverse. The last number of years, whether you're looking at the Spezzas or, you know, Tavares, obviously way back when, but, you know, a lot of GTA area players have chosen to come back to the Leafs. And you know, I just think it's the similar kind of drain going the other way. I don't get the sense that any of these, like, I want to be careful with this because I don't think it's like he or a lot of his countrymen hate living or playing in Canada. I just think they're more comfortable at home. And I can understand that. I mean, I've been to all the league's 32 cities and there's a lot of them it would be weird if I had to pick up and move to tomorrow just because, you know, well, we, you know, it's the same continent. It's the same language predominantly and all those things. I mean, there are differences between areas of this continent.
The only thing I would say to that, guys, is like, I obviously follow the NBA pretty closely. And there are a lot of situations where player X doesn't want to go to destination Y. The team trades for him anyway. He gets there, he's like, oh, this is pretty good. And then he signs there. Like forever, an example, like Paul George wanted to go to LA. Then he gets traded to the Clippers, or then he gets traded to OKC. He signs in OKC. And then of course he gets traded to LA. But the point is, like, you just don't know. Like maybe a guy gets there and he's like, oh, this is pretty good. This is not like what I thought it would be. But I understand the risks. We don't have a ton of time. So I did want to ask you, CJ, about the centers just because
the other thing with the US,
yeah,
like you can play in a lot of those places with way less day-to-day scrutiny.
Yes, true.
Family, whatever. I mean, let's face it, like the Canadian markets are unhinged. Thank goodness it gives us our jobs and, you know, it allows us to do what we do because there's so much interest in the sport that we've dedicated our lives to. But the fact remains, a lot of those places you can have a much easier day-to-day life away from the rink in the U.S. cities. Not all of them, but the large majority of them.
That is true. I do want to ask you about the centers just because there just aren't a lot available and the Leafs need one. Henrik Wennberg are kind of the two big ones. I guess you could throw Granlund is kind of on your list. He's different. What do you think like the top line price will be for like Henrik would be obviously the top one. So he would kind of set the top. Like, do you think he gets a first? What do you think teams are willing to pay for him?
I think there's a chance he gets a first. You know, Edmonton is one of the teams that have a lot of interest in Adam Henrik, and certainly they have a first round pick that I think they're going to move at this deadline to, as part of whatever work they do. You know, it's funny, Nick Dowd's available in Washington, you know, depth kind of player with one more year on his deal. And there's talk that they want a first round pick for him. So, you know, and there's precedent for that. I mean, Barclay Goodrow shocked a lot of people when Tampa sent a first round pick to San Jose a couple deadlines ago, and he had one more year of team control at a really affordable contract. And, you know, he got his name carved in the Stanley Cup twice because of that trade. So, you know, you might be surprised at some of it, but I will say this, I feel like there's not as much demand for forwards, like hot demand. I mean, certainly a couple teams like Vegas and Edmonton are two I would say are very likely to make a move, you know, for some of the impactful forwards, but you know, I think the price will come down on the forwards. So, you know, maybe it's not an Adam Henrik, but certainly some other players out there I think are going to, the sellers might be in for a rude awakening by Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern time, because I don't see enough high value capital on the table to satisfy the market. When you have, you know, there's a number of pretty good players, right? You've got Henrik, you've got Tarasenko, who's a winger, of course, but you know, the same names. You got Gensel. I mean, there's only so many teams that are going to be paying first rounders for those types of guys. And so, you know, maybe the smart move for a team like the Leafs, you know, who I don't think will spend a first round pick on a forward. I could be wrong there, but I don't get that sense. You know, maybe the smart move is to hang around and try to get someone cheap as it gets closer to 3 p.m. on Friday.
There's been so much talk about the Leafs needing defense. They get Lyubushkin. Is there a world where that's all they do on D and they get more aggressive in trying to address the need at center?
I think they're open to both. You know, it's almost like, I think they're less focused on, we have this specific need. I mean, obviously as a team, they have identified needs they have, or, you know, maybe skill sets that they want to add to their group, but it's almost as much like, we only have this to spend. What is the best way to spend it? It's like when you're a kid and you get the allowance and you got like $3 and you go to the convenience store and it's like, what is the best way to spend your $3 to maximize what you can get for your sugar rush? So I think that is kind of the approach that's being taken here. I mean, look, I do think, you know, it's been said for a long time, the Leafs were looking for two defensemen at this deadline. They got one. You know, as I read in your story this morning, James, you rightly noted that you're not washing Ilya Lyubushkin through another team and you know, spending another pick to get him at 50% and not make further moves. You know, I really do think that they're going to get another player that can play on the right side of their blue line. Doesn't necessarily, of course, mean it's a right-hand shot, but that would probably be preferable at this point. And so there's lots of ways they can create the cap room to do it. It's just about, what is the asset cost? And, you know, I checked in this morning, even on Sean Walker, who's one of the top names on the board, not as it pertains to the Leafs specifically, but I think Philadelphia is still to a point where they're having an internal debate. Like, do we just resign them or keep them as our own rental? Because, you know, it seems like the market's a little bit soft there. You know, this is just such a strange deadline. It feels like we're back to the grade six dance. Like, everyone's looking around at each other all awkward. No one knows what to do. And so, you know, last year just felt like some of the top players went for first rounders. It got very aggressive. And I think we saw 12 first rounders moved in total at last season's deadline. It just, you know, Sean Monahan and Elias Lindholm, you know, moved for those kind of prices. But I just don't see a lot of fervor in the market. And so I think if you're in Brad Treliving's position, you have to be patient and rely on your instincts and rely on all the work that he and his scouts and front office have put in and getting the intel, and, you know, might be making some decisions at 249 on Friday afternoon that impact, you know, what happens here the rest of the way for the Leafs.
You kind of offhand mentioned earlier the idea of TJ Brody going out in a trade to create some cap space. I mean, the other guy here that the organization is frustrated with is Liljegren. Like, do you think there's a world where they're moving a D like that out just to change the stylistic fit on the back end, and they want to bring in someone who's, for lack of a better term, you know, more like Labushkin and add like another piece like that?
Well, any scouts that were watching last night's game might not be going to their GM and advocating that trade, but you know, sorry, that's harsh, but you know, it's been an up and down season for Liljegren. I does feel like his time in Toronto was perilously dangling by a thread at this point. I mean, it's like the same two things happen every year. We get to the playoffs and he's scratched, and we return for training camp and there's talk about how he's got to grab onto a top four job. And yeah, you know, obviously this year, you know, his season was interrupted with that high ankle sprain he suffered in Boston. And, you know, I'm not sure, there's been periods where he's got it together, but maybe, you know, he struggled physically and just missing that much time has been difficult. But, you know, it just feels like with a new GM in place, you know, we're in year, whatever it's been, you know, he hasn't grabbed onto a job. And even if he's not traded out, which I just think it's going to be a tough trade to make. I don't know what his value is at this point in time on the market, what teams would do to trade for him. But I mean, it's possible that he's dealt. And if not, I think there's a big decision coming this offseason, because if they're getting another right shot or right defenseman who's capable of playing the right side at this deadline, it probably means he's out of the lineup. That's how it looks to me. And unless they're obviously bringing in a very, very depth option and he's below Liljegren, but really I think we're talking about them potentially trading for his replacement. So whether he remains in Toronto after that trade or not, he just hasn't grabbed a job, and it might be a stylistic thing, but just doesn't feel like he's long for the Leafs. That's kind of my sense of where he's at.
All right. Well, last thing, because you mentioned like maybe it's just another defenseman. Maybe James, I think, mentioned a depth defenseman. I guess I just don't really understand the point of that. Like, it just feels like they have a lot of like those guys, and that if you're not going to get someone who can legitimately play in your top four, like, what's the point? Do you disagree with me? What am I missing? Maybe like, I like Nick Seeler. I just don't know what Nick Seeler really does for this particular defense.
I think some of it is just you're counting on injuries. I mean, the Leafs blue line's been pretty banged up this year. You know, Labushkin sounds like, you know, he returned, but he got hurt in his first game here. I mean, I think part of it's that, you know, and part of it is bringing a different element. I think that they're looking for, I'm like, I don't know the right word. Is it like a little bit more of a black and blue, you know, someone who can eat pucks and box out at the net and, you know, kill plays and just, you know, look at the game is played differently in the playoffs. Leafs fans know that as well as anyone, because their 115 point regular seasons have not translated into a ton of playoff success. And there's probably a bunch of reasons for that. But one of them is that the way the team has played during those regular seasons hasn't always been conducive to the playoff success. So I think that they're, you know, that's why you hear them attached to a Savard or even a Zach Bogosian. You know, I think as another player, they're looking at least seeing if they could bring back if Minnesota isn't successful in extending him. You know, those types of guys can kill penalties, block shots, and play kind of a very unsexy game, but a game that I think can have some success in the playoffs. So I think part of it, Jonas, would just be changing the dynamic on the back end. And you know, look, they'd probably rather bring in someone who could be a top pairing player. It's just, that's not in the offing with what's available, what they have to spend. And so this is, you know, this isn't about making the team perfect. I think it's about finding incremental gains where you can on the roster.
Yeah. It's like you go to the restaurant and like, this is all they have. So you just have to like, you're hungry. So you just got to eat something, right? Whatever they have, you'll take.
Basically. Sounds like covering the Olympics or working the late night covering a game.
I never ate more cheeseburgers in my life than in Sochi, where the only thing there was to eat literally was McDonald's.
Those were good times. All right. Well, CJ, we appreciate you taking some time. We know you're busy. Go listen to the Chris Johnson Show. Go read CJ's new trade board. Just came out yesterday. Chris, we know you're busy. Thank you.
Thanks, you guys. CJ. See you soon.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, Everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. Our thank you to Chris Johnson, our buddy. Mark, don't worry. You'll be on again soon. Before we get to questions, James, I just want you to kind of give a brief synopsis of a story you wrote for The Athletic today as we're recording this on Tuesday, just about the Leafs cap situation, because I don't think that's ever totally understood for reasons that are very understandable. It's very complicated. Just give us your little synopsis.
I mean, basically, I think that, you know, Chris said that they were really tight, but I think they can free up enough relatively easily to give them $3.5 million in cap space to spend. And the way they need to do that is shuffling around some of their depth pieces. I mean, just, I think the way to think of it is everyone you waive and take off the roster is giving you at least another close to 800K. So if you do that with three players, you know, it you're creating almost $2.5 million right there. Right. So,
yeah, right.
You know, yes, you risk losing a Noah Gregor or a William Legison, or especially Martin Jones, if they decide to waive him, you risk losing, or Connor Timmins, you risk losing one of them if you put them on waivers. But that's the upside benefit is that you're going to have so much more money to spend at the deadline. So I think the right play for the Leafs is really dig in hard the next 48 hours, because they need to decide by Tuesday afternoon if they're waiving anybody. Really dig in hard, see what's on the table, see what they're likely to be able to do. And if you know that you need some cap space, start putting people on waivers on Wednesday or Thursday. And that's the money. So, you know, fans might get an indication of how big they're going to go at the deadline based on who they waive in the next 2 days. You know, if you see Gregor, Legison, and someone else, or you see, you know, Giordano or Timmins end up on LTIR, that's them setting up to do something more significant.
Is there risk to that? Like where you would waive a guy and then you just don't get anyone? Like, that's not really making that big a difference. Like, if you lose Noah Gregor on waivers, like, it doesn't really change anything. And I guess if you're adding, you're pushing those guys down the depth chart anyway, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're gonna have to go on waivers no matter what, right? Because you need the roster spot. Like, right now, they're right at their limit for roster spots. So,
right.
I think that's why you want to kind of know what your plan is going into the deadline and what you have on the table. I mean, you could even say to the team you're dealing with, like, hey, we need to free up some cap space. Or what you could do is in the trade, you could include like a Legison or a Gregor. I mean,
yeah,
the only thing then is you for sure lose them if you do that. Whereas you might want to have them as depth, like if you run into, say, two or three injuries at a certain position.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I mean, like right now, I think Legison would be their number seven. So you add another defenseman, he becomes your number eight. Like, that's pretty good. Like, if he's your eight, that's fine. But like, if Lajoie is your seven or eight, like, you're a little more nervous. But yeah, I think that's a really good point. I guess the other thing is like the retention angle. Like, if you wanted to do the double retention, then you're having to send another asset out, and they don't really have a lot of assets. Like, do you think they've maximized their double retention, or am I overthinking?
Well, I mean, the only thing I would say to that is that getting the double retention on Lyubushkin, the price was a sixth round pick. So,
yeah, like, who cares, you know, right?
That's a guy who's only making 2.75. So the double retention is not a lot of money. It's like 700K. So if it's, you know, if you want to do double retention on, I don't know. I mean, I was going to say David Savard, but he's got one more year left on his deal. So it's a bit more complicated than that. But it really depends. Like when they did the double retention with Ryan O'Reilly last year,
yeah,
I believe the cost was a fourth round pick. So And the double retention for O'Reilly was quite a bit more. I mean, he's a guy that was making $7.5 million. So that's kind of been the established price. So if they're going to do it, the only thing is, Jonas, I don't think they have to do double retention unless they're adding two players. If they're adding one player, they don't need to do it, because at 50% retained, they can add a $7 million player. I don't see them adding anyone that makes more than that. So
yeah, like the guy I was thinking of is Henrique, who makes like, what is it, five point something?
5.3, I want to say. Yeah, he makes quite a bit for sure. So yeah, I think if you wanted to add him and another defenseman, then yeah, you would probably have to do the double retention and run him through another team.
Okay. Let's get to questions. I do think I mentioned Savard. I do think, like I wrote, I kind of think like logically just where they're at, who's available, maybe he makes the most sense. But anyway, let's get to some questions.
Well, I asked you this before, like when you brought him up yesterday when we were just chatting, like, do you think all of a sudden their defense gets too many guys that are like, if you have Lyubushkin and Savard and Benoit, there's a lot of guys that bring a very similar element, but I guess maybe what you're looking for is have one of them on each pairing kind of thing. And then,
yeah. So the way I ended up like, just like theoretically playing around with it is like, you'd have Riley Lyubushkin, Brody Savard, Benoit McCabe. And then like, if what you're talking about becomes an issue, like puck moving becomes an issue, you can always put Liljegren in, and suddenly it's McCabe Liljegren is your third pair. And that helps a little bit more. I just like, we've just seen this story over and over again, like how you need to basically build two defense cores, one for the regular season and one for the playoffs. And he fits like what you need in the playoffs. I think the question is like, are you comfortable sending out a first round pick for that type of player at his age, risk of injury, all that? I don't know. Like I think I would really consider it, but I could understand you or them shrugging at that and saying, no, it's just too much.
I do think he would cost a first round pick, because as CJ said, he's not a rental. So
right. And 1.75 for this year next, like that's pretty good. Like if he's on your defense for 1.75, McCabe's making $2 million, suddenly you can go into free agency and like spend whatever on, I don't know, there's not a ton of guys, but you know what I mean? Like suddenly you have more optionality, I guess.
Yeah. And the thing, I mean, at this point, it seems pretty clear that TJ Brody is not going to be back next year. Even at like a discount, it feels like, I mean, he would have to take such a huge discount to come back here. It feels like the organization's probably ready to move on. And if they're also ready to move on from Liljegren, the blue line could be a little bit barren next year and they're going to need to add people. So that's why I like the idea of like an Adam Larson or someone who's going to be part of your team beyond this year with a trade. It makes a lot of sense if you can make it happen. So it's going to be interesting. I get this sneaking suspicion that the Leafs aren't going to be able to do what they want to do at this deadline, but maybe I'm going to end up being wrong on that.
Well, do you think like you just have to entice a team? Like if you went to Seattle with a really, I don't know what that offer would look like, but a really juicy offer and made them really think about it, like maybe you can bowl them over. You know what I mean?
Yeah. If you really feel like that's the piece you want, then I don't know why you wouldn't have those conversations. But you know, I would think the tricky thing with Seattle is that they were good last year, took a big step back this year. They want to be good. It's the same as like a team like New Jersey or, you know, these teams that had designs on being good this year and they just had a really disappointing season. They need to think about next season too. So are they going to give up guys that have term that can help them next year?
Yeah.
All right. Whereas like Montreal, it's like they're not going to be good next year, right? So, you know, they're probably going to be in this position next year where they're trading David Savard at the deadline. So should they just do it a year early? And, you know, they've got some interesting young defensemen there who they might want to give ice time to. I don't know when the kid from Switzerland's coming over. What's the Reinbacher? Is that the right name? The Habs defenseman. Like they need to create some room on their blue line too. So that could be a factor for them in training somebody. Dustin wants to know, for our first question, is there any chance we see David Kampf moved in a money out deal? $2.4 million seems very steep for someone who is playing the fourth line center role.
Well, and who has three more years. It's just hard to see. Like one of the ones, like I think you or CJ mentioned Nick Dowd. I like Nick Dowd. And if they could simply give Washington Nick Dowd and take, or Washington David Kampf and take back Nick Dowd, that makes a lot of sense. Like Nick Dowd has another year. Washington would in theory get like a younger fourth line center who signed. I mean, do they want to take on that much term for someone who doesn't deliver any offense? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I don't think anyone's going to be.
Yeah,
no one's going to be excited to take Camp. I mean, he hasn't had a good season. How many points does he have? Like, I know he's not a big offensive piece, but and his underlying numbers, like the analytics on Camp, have just completely tanked this year.
They are coming up a little bit. That line's been better, but yeah. I just don't like 3 more years is like, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah. That contract has not worked.
Let me ask you something about him because I've been thinking of all kinds of things with their center ice situation. Would you give any thought at all to just going back to like him as your third line center? And then maybe building like a fourth line that's a little more offense, kind of like Holmberg, Robertson, McMahon or something? Or am I crazy? I don't know
on a fourth line.
Yeah, like maybe your fourth line's like Holmberg, Domi, and Robertson or something. I don't know.
That is very much a offense-driven.
Yeah, you probably can't even play that line in the playoffs. I don't know.
I thought that that's what they would do. The problem is, I don't know. Is Reeves going to be in your playoff lineup, and where does he go? And
yeah, good question.
It goes back to some of the pieces that they've got. I'm not sure how you fit them together. It's kind of like this Franken team sometimes that they've got up front. So
I ask obviously because like since they've done this Domi Bertuzzi Nylander line, 38% expected goals for that group in 8 games.
So yeah, I looked at this yesterday before yesterday's game and the numbers were bad again yesterday, and they were that line, it was the worst performing line that they've used a significant amount this season. I think they've played something like 80 some minutes together at even strength, and they have by far the worst underlying numbers
and like 70% zone starts. It's really not working. So
yeah, and you look like a team like Boston. I mean, the game last night was at home, so less so. But if you're going on the road and that's one of your lines, the other team is just going to try and pick it apart. Like, you know, if you're playing Florida, they're going to be putting Reinhardt and Barkov against that line. And
I mean, that's what Colorado did when the Leafs were in Colorado not that long ago. Is they got their top line against the Domi line, not very much, but they scored twice in like 5 minutes. So
right. Yeah.
Anyway.
And I get that people like that line, like, you know, like I was on JD Bunker's show the other day and he was talking about like how, you know, like it gives the Leafs another line that's unpredictable and that can create offense and like they're fun to watch with what they do at the other end. But I just don't see Keith trusting that line in the playoffs. Like that's why for me, it feels like I think the possibility of them adding another forward or another center, even if it is kind of like a doubt or something like that, I think it's higher probably than has been talked about so far. There's been a lot of focus on defense.
It's just like if you add Dowd, Dowd's kind of like Camp. Like he's like, you know what I mean? Like he's not going to help you offensively. Suddenly, like you have two centers like that. Like, but yeah, like I get that. Like I don't like Nylander as much in this formation either. Like he's playing defense more, so he doesn't have the puck as much. He's not on the attack.
Well, it seems like he's making like his brain dead moves defensively are really standing out. Like it's, you know,
anyway, let's go to more questions.
The one that got him benched.
Yes.
Nicole wants to know, what do you make of Keith being more assertive and blunt in his assessment of the team in his interviews this year? You know, what would bring that on? Number one, I guess the number one question I would have coming out of that, Jonas, do you think he has been more assertive and blunt in with the media this year and about the team?
No, he's always been pretty blunt. Like you can go back and like pick out statements over the years. Remember like elite players, remember that one against Arizona? He's had some, like, he's not been afraid to do that. It's just, remember there were lots of instances where he would kind of walk back stuff he said.
Right.
I don't think we've had as much walking back, if my memory serves.
I think he was kind of like this last year too, right? Like it's like the pressure has been ratcheted up. I think the thing with this year is the team just has struggled for a huge portion of the season, like really up until end of January. You know, it was a very, very, like the first 50 games of the season, it was a very mediocre performance from his team. So naturally you're going to have the coach probably be a little bit more fiery and a little bit more.
Yeah. I think what's changed a little bit is like, he's been more willing to, I don't know what the right word is, like the more pull like a disciplinarian kind of card, where like you think back to that game where their power play was just really bad and he just like stopped playing their number one unit entirely. Or like, you know, you mentioned the Nylander benching the other game, Tavares gets benched. Like that kind of stuff has been happening more, and it's more, it started with the camp scratch, where it's like he literally said like this kind of stuff is not going to be tolerated anymore. So I think that's different. And I think that's something that I think the market in general has been desiring more from coaches here. Do you agree? Like, I kind of think that's where maybe the difference is.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. You know, I mean, for Keith, but every year now for him is vital, right? Like, you know, even with the extension and everything, like he could certainly, he's on the hot seat if they don't win in the first round. So there's pressure there for him to show, you know, they gave him a vote of confidence. And now he has to show that that was the right decision. All right. Simeon has a question, or is it Simeon? I think Simeon, a name. Maybe it's Simon in a European spelling or something. They would like to know, why are right-handed defensemen such a rare commodity in the NHL? It's Joshua Cloak, our colleague, has a story about this on the site today, so I recommend people read that. Is there a particular reason for how players develop or are coached at a young age? I don't know. Did you want to weigh in on that? I mean, I've done some research on this. The interesting thing is that there's a huge percentage of the NHL that shoots left. You know, in hockey players, there seems to be, at the elite level, a lot of... Do you shoot left or right when you play hockey, Jonas?
Left.
See, I shoot right. But you're right-handed, right?
No, I'm left-handed.
Oh, okay.
Right. Which is interesting because, like you mentioned all this stuff, James, like in baseball, left-handed pitchers are like a commodity. They're kind of like the right shooting defenseman of the NHL. Like,
well, do you know what percentage of pitchers throw left?
I don't, but I can actually look it up really quickly.
But hockey is kind of weird because there's so many people who are right-handed that shoot left. Now, I'm right-handed and I shoot right. You're left-handed, you shoot left. But what's different in hockey is there's a lot of people who shoot the way that they're not dominant. And for some people, the only thing that they do left-handed is shoot in hockey. Like, even if they golf, they're right-handed.
Do you know what's weird? I'm just pulling up the story. This is from MLB.com. It says only about 10% of the general population is left-handed.
Yes.
So how does that make sense with what you're talking about?
I think 60% or more than 60% of the defensemen in the NHL, I believe, are left shot. It's because a lot of people who are right-handed shoot left. And the theories that I've seen are, if you pick up a hockey stick at a really young age, you're inclined to use your dominant hand on the top of the stick. So if you start playing when you're 2, 3, 4 years old, as a lot of kids do in Canada, when they pick up the stick, they reach for it with their right hand because that's their dominant hand, and that's how they start to shoot. That's the theory that I've seen.
That's fascinating.
It's especially prevalent, I think, among European players. I think if you look at European players, and I don't know why the difference is that, I think European players are much more likely to shoot left. And if you look at European defensemen, there's a ton of left shot defensemen.
Right.
So yeah. I mean, even, you know, like you look even in like playing beer league and stuff, there's a lot of guys that are left shots. So, I mean, this is probably you could do a whole podcast about this probably, but I think scarcity is just a big reason. Like in an ideal world on the blue line, you want to have a left shot and a right shot. It's just easier to play on that side. For a winger, it makes much less difference. It doesn't matter as much. And there's some real advantages to being on your off wing and having your stick, your blade in the center of the ice. For a defenseman, when you need to close off on the boards or you need to make a clear or whatever, you would rather have your stick up against the boards as opposed towards the center of the ice. We saw it on that one goal that went in where Riley was a left shot playing on the right side. Puck comes over beside him, and if he's a right shot, he can make an easy play on it. But as a left shot, it's kind of hard to get in that lane.
Yeah.
So in an ideal world, you want to have a lefty on left D and a righty on right D. But it's hard to do if, you know, the majority of the defensemen in the league are left shots. Gord asks, aside from trades, it seems something should have been learned from the Morgan Riley suspension. That being that these players can learn to play team defense, can keep Rain Riley in, have him move to a more offensive role strategically. Can Domi learn to play a 200-foot game as a center? Can he keep Brody on the left side? These tweaks could yield big results. Let me just break away from some of the points made there in the question and say to you, Jonas, like, do you think that there's something to, you know, Riley misses the five games, the team plays really, really well. Is there something they should take away from that experience?
I don't know. Like, it just feels like too small a sample size, and it does feel like there's a slight psychological element to it. Is that the right word? Where, you know, your number one defenseman is out and everyone, especially the forwards, is like, you can look at the group back there and you're thinking, right? Like, you're thinking, like, I got to be better defensively, and I got to really, like, I can't F up. You know what I mean? And so everything kind of just tightens. Like, if we saw that for 45 games, you know what I mean? And that was a thing, I would have a little more, like, I would have to think about it more, like what it means and why it's happening. But I know you can look back to last year and it's like that 13 and 15 or whatever it was, but that's like a similar thing. I think like the thinking was, well, the forwards really dial in, and I don't know.
Jonas, someone sent me the stat that the last 3 years, the games that Morgan Riley doesn't play, their record is whatever it is. It was like 100 and someone sent me this stat on Twitter. It was like 106 point pace. Like, doesn't this show that they don't need him? And then so I looked at it and I did the numbers and I was like, actually, their record is slightly better when they have him in the lineup. So 106 point pace. But if you look at the last 3 years, like, they've had pretty good records that have been better than 106 points. So I think that the numbers aren't as pronounced as people think.
Well, and let's remember who their best player was in the playoffs last year and who was one of their best players the year before that. Like, he's not their issue. I think the other stuff is like, yeah.
I would say, Jonas, I think sometimes they play him too much in defensive roles and shutdown roles. Where,
well, that's like, not his fault, right? That's
like without a partner who like really helps facilitate that.
That's the problem of like, they just don't have enough. And like, that gets back to like the Muzzin thing. That really, what like really stung them, because he was kind of like the perfect counterpoint to Riley in that he could do all the stuff that Riley couldn't do and do it really well. And you could use him against difficult competition. He plays a lot on the penalty kill, and then you lose him. And like, suddenly you just don't have that. And like, Jake McCabe, like, fine, like he's fine, but he's not that, you know what I mean? Like, that was such a big blow to lose him when they did and how they did and everything like that. And then obviously, like, you know, a lot of the talk, you know, early in the season is, oh, well, Klingberg's just going to go on LTI. They can just replace him. Well, turns out it's hard, like, to replace him, and it's going to cost you something, which is why that signing was like so costly in the first place. Like, you just can't mess up like that, if that makes sense.
Ryan wants to know, are we going to do a mini podcast whenever a trade is made? The Labushkin podcast was a nice surprise. Appreciate it. Thanks, Ryan. We appreciate you. We'll look at the numbers. I mean, that one we recorded at like 3 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, which is not a good time to record and release a podcast. And it did pretty well. So we've been toying with the idea. I was thinking of, Jonas, we should send out a survey and say, would you rather us do more shows that are shorter? You know, kind of like what the audience is looking for. I mean, I think sometimes when we only record once a week and something happens, you know, in the beginning of the week, it's like too long of a wait for us to record another show.
Yes. I mean, the issue is you're very busy as a boss at The Athletic, and I have a lot of
you're traveling and stuff to go to.
And that's our complication. Yeah. So,
but I think just maybe the way to do it for us is like find like 25, 30 minutes and just bang out something more frequently. I don't know what the people's listening habits are. Like, do they want once a week? I don't know. Maybe people can answer in the chat. Darren says, finding a number two center to replace Domi on the Nylander line feels like it should be the top priority, considering how much that line is getting scored on. Is there anyone we like beyond Adam Henrique? Were the Leafs sleeping when Monahan and Lindholm were traded?
I mean, I was talking about Lindholm from the fall, right? Like, I thought that was a bigger... Could they have afforded that price? I guess not, and like done other stuff. Like, what did he go for? He went for a lot.
I think I want to say a first, a second, a prospect, and Kuznetsov. Is that right?
Kuzmenko. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah.
Kuzmenko. Yeah. You're right. So that's a lot. That's more than they can afford. But like another guy, like I like Wennberg as just kind of like a safe reliable. Well,
he's more like a defensive presence, right? Like he's not. Yeah,
he's not going to bring a ton of offense is the issue, yeah. Right?
He's sort of like a Kerfoot kind of, right? But bigger.
Yeah, but bigger and better and like a legitimate center. The issue, like, again, becomes like, how do you kind of figure out the lines if you add someone like that? Like, you're not going to want to play Domi with Tavares as a center.
Well, maybe you try Domi with Wenberg and Yarncroc, and it's kind
yeah,
of like
that's what you would do.
Two good defensive players. Domi's kind of a creator on that line.
Yep. Yeah.
Looking at Henrique, it's like, well, I might just put Domi with Henrique, and like they're veteran NHL players. Like,
yeah,
it's not like Domi can only play in an offense first line, yep. Especially if he's on the wing. So
yeah, it's not perfect, but like, yeah.
It feels like, I don't know, with Henrique, like, if they were going to do that, wouldn't they have just packaged that together with the Lyubushkin trade? Like, I feel like Henrique's not going to be the guy for the Leafs. It just doesn't seem... Sounds like he's going to go to the Rangers or something like that.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay, let's end on this. I think you can weigh in on this pretty good. Thomas wants to know, can you explain in detail why Domi and Bertuzzi are considered poor defensive players? They play with an edge. Seems like they should be good defensively. What is it they don't do that makes them a liability? Please try and be specific. You know what I find, Jonas, is that the eye test is really good at identifying players who are good offensively and creative offensively. And in part because you can just see the puck go in the net, or you can see someone generate scoring chances. But it's much harder to evaluate players defensively just watching the game. But you know, the thing I would say, and I think the way that you and I watch games is, especially when there's a big chance against or when there's a goal against, going back and looking at the play and looking at who missed an assignment and looking at who failed to clear the puck or who made a poor decision in some way. And you and I do that pretty much for every goal against, right? And often for like the big scoring chances. And if you do that enough times, because really what we're looking for is we're looking for what happened. You know, like where was the breakdown? And for me, and I'm sure for you too, like Domi is someone who shows up a lot when you do that, you know, and
yeah,
missed coverages and missed assignments and plays with the puck that he shouldn't have made and things like that.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like to your point, like a lot of times defense can be hard to see. With him, it's really not hard to see. Like it's really glaring where he just kind of loses track of things. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, there's like brain farts where he's just like, oh, that's my man. Or like, he's just kind of not a smart, good defender. Like, and yeah, like it's been really, I don't know what the word is, but it's really popped out even more so when he's at center because the responsibilities are more so. Like they didn't want to play him at center. Like this was not their plan. It just kind of became their plan because other stuff happened. So Bertuzzi is a better defender than he is. But Domi, like you just need to watch stuff back and you can see like, what is he doing in that spot? So, yeah.
Right. And when you're playing center, the demands on you in your own zone are significantly more. I mean, you're expected to, you're basically like the third defenseman. You're almost like a rover in your own end. I know from in beer league, sometimes when I have to play center, it's like, oh man, like, and it's a lot more skating. It's a lot more handling the puck.
Yes.
Sometimes you're back behind your own net. Sometimes you're in front of sometimes you have to clear the coverages in front of the net or in the slot. Whereas the wingers, it's much more simple where you're most of the time where you're playing in your own zone. And, you know, I think what it comes down to I think you're right. I think Bertuzzi's probably, I would say, an average defensive player.
Yeah.
Probably what I would say. Whereas Domi's objectively not a good defensive player and never has been. And I think for him, I don't think it's something you can change at what's Domi now, 28, 29 years old. I think
he just
had his birthday, right? Like, happy birthday, Max. we're talking about how you're not good defensively. I mean, there's just some players in the NHL that they don't have a mind for the defensive side of the game and where to be and how to play, the same way that there are players like David Kampf who don't have a mind for the offensive side of the game. So,
yeah, right.
And I think that's just who Domi is, and the Leafs are going to have to work around that and coach around it.
All right. Well, James, I think we'll be back at the end of the week, potentially. We'll see what the Leafs do at the trade deadline. We'll see if they make a big splash, if they get a center, if they get another defenseman, if they get a big upgrade on defense.
We should probably record Friday night, right? Like, that's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Friday at 6 o'clock or something.
Yeah, so we'll plan on that. So stay tuned for that. Obviously, some big games ahead for the Leafs. They play Buffalo on Wednesday, and they're in Boston on Thursday, just before the deadline, and then they play on Saturday. So we'll be back. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to CJ for coming on, as always. See you, James.